The aim of Culturico's podcasts is to provide the listener with an artistic yet realistic mosaic of human pictures. Macroscopic events of our society result from a complex combination of individual dreams and ambitions. We provide stories that have humans as their core element, from macro stories about our multifarious culture, including politics, society, and science, to micro stories of individuals' hopes, struggles, and change. Our stories are told by people with their own life experiences, beliefs, and reflections of past and present events. We therefore provide a multifaceted image of our world, observed and understood from different perspectives.
All right. Hello and welcome, everyone, to the latest episode of the Culturico podcast. My name is Umena Aziz. I am the editor-in-chief at Culturico. And as I feel like I mention every time, I'm an engineer by education and a feminist by passion, and I will be your host today. With me, I have Professor Shafiq Karim Kurel, and he is currently the assistant professor at Manipal Center for Humanities at the Manipal Academy of Higher Education, which is located in the coastal town of Manipal in southern Karnataka, India. I hope I pronounced that correctly. His ongoing research is on the cultural expressions of migration from Kerala to the countries of the Arab Gulf. In his published works, he has looked at the media of migrant film, photography, and literature. So let's begin with your personal history. I think that's a very important question to get to know how you got interested in this topic in particular. So, Professor, could you tell me what is your personal history with migration?
Hello, everyone. Thank you, Umena, for this wonderful opportunity for me to speak to your audience. My interest began, actually, my personal history with the Gulf is that I have spent a considerable part of my childhood in the Gulf, in UAE. I was just 3.5 when I first made my first journey to the Gulf. My father was employed there for 3 decades plus, and I had spent a good number of years of my childhood in Badazayed, which is in the Emirate of Abu Dhabi in UAE. Now, so, I mean, that is the personal history part. But then if there is one factor which led me to researching the Gulf, migration from the Gulf, then it from Kerala to the Gulf, then it would, I mean, I would pinpoint on this one time in which I decided to collect photographs of my childhood in the Gulf. And I noticed that they were actually, because there are very interesting things here, which is that because we as a family, I mean, my mother, father, brother, sister, we were there as a family, but most people around were not there as families, but were there as single men, usually. It so happens that a lot of people, not just my family, but others, like my uncles, for example, many people actually have my childhood photos. Like, you know, I mean, because of this, because we happen to be a family and then we used to be there on these occasions, it so happens that many of them have photos from my childhood. And I started collecting them. And that was actually the beginning of this. I mean, if there was one incident which began this research, that would be, it would be that point.
So just in the interest of full disclosure, I have actually personal family history with the UAE as well, because my father and his two brothers, all of them, as soon as they finished their education, they moved to the UAE to for work as well. And they were all basically there with their family. So I spent maybe a year out of my baby life in Alain. That's where my father was situated at that time. So I find this very interesting that you mentioned specifically the fact that being a family there was not very common. It was definitely more common to see these instances of single men going and working in search of jobs, in search of more opportunities. So once you
single men who had to live like 10 people in a room. I mean, these are people who could not afford to have their families there because then they would have had to spend the entire rent from their pockets while, you know, sharing it with 9 other people in a small, I mean, like, you know, just one small rectangle in the middle. I used to also, I mean, because I used to go to Abu Dhabi at least once a month, I used to accompany my father when he used to go to get salary. And also, I used to stay with my uncles there. And I have actually seen, like, you know, as a child, I have seen the kind of living conditions there. These 10 people, bunk beds. So all of them were kind of important biographical part, which led me to my research.
So going back to when you started collecting the photographs, so that's more of how you got started, maybe let's say a little more personally. So how did you go about this in a more professional or academic manner? Because I did see you have a lot of academic papers published on this, on the media that's produced by the migrants. And we'll talk about this a little bit more. But I also want to talk a little bit about your professional or academic methods of studying and recording this phenomenon.
Well, professionally, I have a PhD in cultural studies. So I'm kind of trained in cultural theory. One field which is of quite interest to me is visual culture. I have been teaching film studies for a few years now. So film studies, photography, these are things that interest me. So I was kind of equipped to deal with the materials that I have. But at the same time, if you read the papers are also trying to tell you a story in the sense that, yes, it's academic. Yes, it references theories. Yes, it refers to what work has been done before. But ultimately, I'm telling a story, even if it's about these group of men who are working in a labor camp, who live in a labor camp and work there, or if it's about these two brothers who took a photograph when they were small boys, and then, you know, how their biographies shaped up, like, you know, so it was basically, I mean, if you look at that one paper, Reading Aspiration, it is family history. Mm-hmm. It is kind of a story, but, you know, of course, it's written academically, but I would say that these are, I mean, of course, academic writing has its own protocols, but ultimately, I'm also trying to narrate a story there, a story which has to be said academically, because otherwise, lots of people have said these stories. But within the field of academics, there is a space, a room for these stories, because no one has told these stories there in the field of academics. And basically, I'm just telling that story there.
That is very interesting. Mm-hmm. And it absolutely comes across in your writing as well. You do see how this is not just a theoretical endeavor on your part, but something you feel personally connected to and personally very strongly about. And here at Culturico, that is something that we are very interested in exploring, how the current limits and bounds of academic writing may limit it, or how they can be changed and how they are changing. So we're very glad to have you here and to discuss more on how you are using academic writing to tell maybe a little more intimate side of the stories rather than just a theoretical overview of how things have changed. And going further on your paper, so I read your paper, especially about the brothers that you mentioned, and you read about these Kerala migrations and their after effects, and it shows your empathy towards these migrants whose lives and whose experiences somehow always appear to be secondary in both the countries where they originate from, so back home, so to say, and the home they have chosen to work in. So both countries tend to, because the migrant back home is out of sight, And you know what they say, out of sight, out of mind. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. in the countries where they work in, they come in as migrants and they don't even have the opportunity to gain a path towards citizenship, which gives some kind of, let's say, legal authority or to feel more like a different class of resident in that country. So why do you think it's like this? Why are these experiences of the migrants given secondary status in both the places where they used to live and then where they currently chose to live?
One of the ironies of this migration from Kerala has been that it has not been integrated into the history of Kerala. See, if you see the history of Kerala, a lot of people might be aware of this, but generally in the interest of a good story, let mm-hmm. me tell you. I mean, Kerala historically has been a place of migrants.
In the sense that
if you look at, for example, Kerala as we know it today was came into existence only in 1956, but I'm speaking about this geographical region that we call Kerala. So if you look at Jewish history, for example, the first Jews who arrived in India, mm-hmm. they arrived in Cochin, in Kerala. This was in 6th century BC. In later Jewish history, for example, in 15th century, when they were expelled from Spain, a group of them came to Kerala. If you look at Christian history, you will see that there is a very strong belief among many Christians in Kerala that St. Thomas, who was a disciple of Jesus Christ, mm-hmm. he came to Kerala. He fled because he had to flee the Roman authorities. Mm-hmm. Where he ended up was in Kerala, and he is supposed to have built 6 churches here. The first churches in India are in Kerala. Mm-hmm. In 6th century AD, we have Thomas of Cana coming here from Iraq. Again, setting up some of the oldest churches in the world in Kerala. If you look at the history of Muslims here, I'm not saying this is the history of all the Muslims or all the Christians, but these are community remembrances, of course. The first Muslim in Kerala is supposed to be during the time of Prophet Muhammad himself.
Really?
The lore is that when the Prophet, the king of Kerala at that point of time, of course, it was not known as Kerala, it was the Chera kingdom, and mm-hmm. Zamorin or Samudri was the king. He happened to hear of the Prophet. I mean, the lore is much bigger, which is that he happened to see the miracle of the splitting moon mm-hmm. and he remembers it. And when merchants come from Arabia, he inquires if they know anything, and then he comes to know of the Prophet. Now these merchants were going to Sri Lanka. When they were on their way back, they take this king with them, and then they go to Yemen. Then they go to the Arabian Gulf, and he met Prophet Muhammad. He is given a different name. And then on his way back, he dies in Salalah, in the present-day Oman. And his grave is there.
Okay.
In the early 20th century, other communities, for example, traced their ancestry to Sri Lanka and other countries. Mm-hmm. So basically, this state is a state of migrants. It has this self-history, I mean, self-narration of migration. Whether it is true or not is, of course, these are matters of contention. There are historians who say that, you know, not all of it is correct to in equal measures, all of that. Mm-hmm. But the point is, there is a self-reflection that Kerala has about itself, which is that it is connected to the outside world. So it is part of its self-image that this place is part of international politics rather than just national politics. Mm-hmm. Now, this is where we get the irony, because if you look at Gulf migration and if you look at how Gulf migrants have been integrated into the history of Kerala, it is only as people who labor outside and send money home.
Yes.
What is not integrated is how has this money, I mean, it has, of course, I mean, scholars have studied that it has reduced poverty, it has redistributed wealth better. But, I mean, you see how abstract these things are, right?
Yes.
In the sense that reducing poverty or redistribution of wealth, these are all data. What happens actually to people, to landscape, to houses? These have been studied, but these have been studied very less. There are only a handful, I mean, less than a handful of people who have studied these aspects. So it is this that I intended to study, in the sense that these are migrants who have stories to themselves, who have a particular biography, but who also have dreams and who also are capable of humanly activities, you know, which does not only involve labor, leisure, for example, or intellectual activities, or the power to narrate. All of these,
yes,
are what is what makes human, right? In the sense that this is what we understand by living a full life, for example. But if you look at the figure of the migrant is a laboring body. Now, he does not seem to have these other capacities, the capacity to dream, the capacity to fantasize, the capacity to change things at home, mm-hmm. change the history at home, which is not just data. This is something that I wanted to study. As, you know, this is what I wanted to bring into the field of academics. Of course, I'm not the first person to have brought this. There are great scholars who have walked. For example, Osella have studied the social impact of migration to a good extent. There are others who have studied the effect of migration on cinema.
So how would you say then your work is different from what they
exactly,
have done?
Exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm. So what would be different about my work is the attention that I give to these medium, for example, mm-hmm. in the sense that there's photography, for example, migrant photography. In fact, the most ubiquitous of all migrant expression is migrant photography, because you don't see much literature by migrants. You won't see many films by migrants. These are, in many ways, things which require a lot more capital. You know, all the early migrants to the Gulf, they were from poor families, they were of low educational background. They definitely had limitations when it came to producing literature. Mm-hmm. That is one thing. The other thing is, it is also not clear if the prevalent language of literature allowed them to write, because, you know, again, they would have had to write, and this is the kind of literature that we see. And, you know, in the stories of labor, it is always about toiling and it is always about oppression. But if you look at their photographs, you see a very different world from these, because it is in photographs that we see that there has been a change. Like, you know, there is a change in the way in which the migrants look at themselves. Of course, even mm-hmm. photography has its own genric limitations. For example, people hardly photograph sad moments.
Exactly, but exactly.
But it is precisely how people hardly write about laughing laborers. You understood?
Yeah.
Both of these are actually, you know, genric limitations. But the fact that the popularity of camera, because, you know, I mean, you have Kodak and Yashica, all these,
yes.
you know, very cheap cameras.
But the rolls that had to be developed.
Yeah, the roles that had to be developed was a problem, and they had to be developed. But because they were developed in the Gulf, these migrants could also get these bulky albums as gifts, compliments. You know? So they would send home these. Yeah, I mean, these huge albums, they were not bought. They were usually gifted, mm-hmm. You know, by people or by the studios. So this would be the difference in my work, which is that my work has been a combination of the media that is produced with the individual lives of the migrants. Now, both of these have been studied separately, but such a combination, as far as I know, have not been made in the Indian context. Of course, I have seen a few, not many, but I've seen a few works in other contexts which study such things. For example, I mean, it just comes to my mind. I happened to read an interesting paper for those in the audience. If you want to check out this particular paper, it is titled "I'm Doing Fine in Vienna." But there have also been some other works. For example, there are people who have worked on like one single passport photograph. And then, if you would remember, Umena, my own work was heavily dependent on listening to images by Tina Kampt. I mean, these are some of the works that had interested me quite a bit. But as far as I know, no one had studied these photographs. Because, you know, I mean, in each place, all these cultural expressions have their own genealogy and history, right? So, no, as far as I knew, no one had attempted such a study in the Kerala context. And it's very important because, you know, this Kerala migration to the Gulf is now 50 years old, more than 50 years old, because it was in the second half of the 1960s that the first generation of migrants started going to the Gulf, and they went there through illegal means. Because, you know, I mean, at that point of time, if you remember, most countries came into existence only in 1971. Mm-hmm. So this is a migration which happened even before the present geography, present political landscape of the Gulf has had even come into existence.
So would you say that this migration is, or this labor that came about from this migration is one of the factors that led to the current geography and the current economy? It's one of the building blocks, so to say.
It is part of the oil boom which happened. It is in as much as the oil boom itself was the cause of the current geography that we see. Of course, I mean, there are many reasons as to why this migration had to happen. Those who have worked on Gulf migration have pointed out how there was also these insecurities about getting a lot of labor from same place.
You know, really?
Because, yeah, before the 60s, much of migrant laborers in the Gulf came from other Arab countries, Egypt, Iraq,
okay,
etc. Mm-hmm. But then there were reasons for the rulers in the Gulf countries to be wary of a large number of other Arabs in their territories. So which is when the Gulf states, they decide to import labor from a whole range of places such that, you know, it does not cause any instability. So this entire question of not getting citizenship,
yes,
is associated with that particular mode of thinking in which, you know, the natives have become like 10% or 20% of the population of the entire region. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, you have 80% migrants. But
wow,
the stability has to be maintained because of this quota system in which you make sure that the labor force does not come from the same region, but they come from multiple places, multiple nations. So this is how Kerala migrants make it to the Gulf. It's like a rumor, actually, because there's a 1980 Malayalam movie which for the first time showed Gulf, okay? Mm-hmm. It is shot in places, it's shot in Dubai and places in Sharjah, Porfakan. Now, it says, I mean, in the beginning, there's a voiceover, and the voiceover says that, I mean, first, it initially tells about the other migrations that people from Kerala had. For example, in the early 20th century, most people used to migrate to Ceylon, which is now called Sri Lanka.
Mm-hmm, yes.
Then in the 50s, 40s and 50s, most people used to migrate to Malaya and Singapore. It is in the late 60s, early 70s that people started migrating to the Gulf countries. So this 1980 movie, it begins by saying that in the beginning of this decade, there were rumors of a land of gold on the other shores of the sea.
Mm.
And then many young men took to the ships to reach that shore. And this is about a group of, I mean, this is about a guy actually, but it begins with this group of young men who are setting sail for Arabia in these dhows, in these wooden ships.
Yes. Okay. So, Professor, before we go on any further, there are a couple of things I want to circle back to. You spoke about how the migrant is seen as a laboring body. And I find this very interesting that the literary output or the artistic output or the more philosophical output of the migrant is really, I'm feeling very strongly about this, that it's not as much in the forefront of the figure of the migrant as when we think about one. Even now, when we, so I'm just, again, I'm on a bit of a tangent, but in Pakistan, when we talk about the people, they call them expats who are living abroad. Not all of us are expats. I find that word very privileged because that's just, I find it a very privileged word to refer to people who move away from home for work as expats. But they talk, mainly the talk is about foreign remittance, the money that is sent home, how that money is going to help the country, how that money is going to build the country. And I feel, as somebody who has lived away from home for a while as well, that this is, we're only referred to in terms of the financial means or benefit that we can provide to the country. But if we talk about the political aspects of a country, we are told that since we do not live there, we do not know the on-the-ground situation, we should not talk about it. And it's the same in the country that we choose to live in, because we might not be citizens, or we might not have been born here, we might not have been living here for a long time, that in the country that we have chosen to live in, it is also, it can also be dangerous to talk about politics or to talk about, let's say, the general circumstances or events happening in a country. So this was a very interesting point that you talked about. And over here, that's why I want to focus now on the part of the media that you talk about movies and you talk about photos. So I want to veer a little bit into this direction, especially the home cinema that you talk about, that you have written the paper about. I if you could give us a little bit of the introduction and your focus there, that would be really nice, because I don't want to focus on just the labor aspect of the migrants as well.
Yeah, but before I go into home cinema, now the interesting part of this laboring body is that it is a perversion of an earlier narrative, in the sense that labor is, if you go by a Marxist angle, labor is what makes us human. Labor is what is integral to us as human beings, right? What makes it integral, I mean, what makes humans unique, I mean, from a very traditional perspective, is that we have these opposable thumbs, which allow us to wield weapons, tools, which allow us to work. Now, there is a way in which labor was always connected to citizenship, in the sense that you have the right over land because you have worked on that land. So you also have the right to decide the destiny of that land. You know, so you constitute the people because you are the laboring masses. But what happens is that when the migrant is presented as a laboring body, it can also be a very well-intentioned kind of a claim, in the sense that it can, because we do not yet have a language in which, you can claim ownership. We do not have a progressive language. Of course, capitalism just needs you to have the papers for, and that is how you own a land.
Yes.
But a more progressive approach will be that you labor on the land, and therefore the land belongs to you. The fruits of your labor belong to you. Will be the unalienated condition, right? So initially, to see the migrant body as laboring body would also be an effort to claim for the migrant a position where he is laboring, in the sense that it could be a way to demand that the migrant should have a stake in the place that he labors. Mm-hmm. But what has happened is that this laboring, this prevalence, this hegemony of this concept, precisely because it is a progressive concept, and especially, for example, in a place like Kerala, which has, in the public sphere, a hegemony of this progressive language, mm-hmm. to claim that the migrant is a laboring body would also be to ask, to make demands on part of his laboring body. But at the same time, and I want to draw your attention to Rancière's wonderful work, Jacques Rancière's wonderful work, The Knights of Toil, in which he looks at, these laboring masses of 19th century France. We think that, laboring masses only labor, but he is looking at the kind of paintings and at the kind of literature and at the kind of different artworks that they produce to show that, for a long time, we have had this division of people who labor and then the people who theorize on the people who labor. But if you look at what the workers themselves are doing, they're theorizing for themselves. I mean, one can see that they were not just laboring bodies. Now, it is time to, what has happened is precisely this, which is that when we see the migrant body as laboring body alone, what we are also denying is the fact that this migrant has a cultural existence.
Yes.
More than just a mechanical existence, in the sense that one of the things is that a laboring body has to be now, because of capitalism, has to be now non-alienated, right? Mm-hmm. So as of now, he is alienated and therefore not fully human. There's a catch to this entire discourse, because when you say laboring body, you are also saying that it's an alienated body. But at the same time, there are other places, other spaces where this migrant can exist to reflect and maybe to argue about his own condition. And for this, we require to go beyond this idea of this fetish of the toiling body.
I really liked the phrase you used, the people who labor and then the people who theorize about those who labor. That does seem like a very clear distinction to make about where all the theories and the terms and everything else is coming from. I appreciate this. And this is a very different way of thinking about citizenship and the rights to the fruits of the labor. I hadn't thought about it in this way, that it's not always a negative term to think of the migrant as a laboring body. Thank you for this. So with that, I do want to now turn the conversation towards home cinema.
Oh, yeah. I forgot that part of the question.
I do want to talk about it because it was very interesting to me, because personally, I do not think I have ever seen a film like this, or I've ever even heard of it, these circumstances. So could you please give us a little bit of an introduction about these films and how they originate?
So this home cinema, it's also called home films, home video. These are not basically what we generally refer to as home video, which is that, you take a camera and shoot whatever is happening at home. No, this is not that. This is basically a proper noun. Which basically in the beginning of the 2000s. So, see, in the beginning of 2000s is a very peculiar time, right? Because if you remember, just before that, we had a VHS cassette. And then the turn of the millennium, and slowly, it's not even that slowly, maybe in another 3-4 years, all the VHS cassettes disappear, right? And then you only have CD shops. All those cassette rental shops suddenly became CD rental shops. And soon they all went away also. If you look at the villages, none of them exist anymore, right?
Exactly. I remember my parents got their wedding video. It was on VHS. They got it converted to a DVD as well because they were scared that they've given away their VCR. They won't be able to watch it.
Yeah, I mean, how do people watch all these things anymore? Yeah. I mean, of course, there are ways perhaps, but not easily available.
Yeah.
Now, this is the time. So there is the protagonist of the story, this home cinema trend, is a school teacher who used to have a drama troupe. So they used to perform plays. But when cable television came, they realized that, you know, people do not come to watch theater as they used to do earlier. Because, you know, I mean, earlier, before the coming of cable channel, we had only one or two channels. So, of course, these theaters, I mean, traveling theaters, when they come to the village, it's something to watch. But not when, you know, you have hundreds of channels, right? You have like so many Malayalam channels themselves. So many movies are playing at the same time. I mean, everything has changed, okay? By the end of this 90s, things have changed drastically. Now, this particular guy, Salam Kodiyathur is his name, school teacher, they started making movies on cassettes. So the first two movies they made on this VHS cassettes. Now there, the idea is, I mean, to post facto, it is a very simple idea, which is that if you're making a movie, and this, remember, this is, YouTube is not yet popular. Remember, the early 2000s.
Yeah.
So, you know, the internet was not even so fast.
Exactly.
I remember having to travel 60 kilometers to reach the nearest internet cafe.
So, oh, wow.
That time. So in those days, they bring out this cassette. And instead of going through this theater route, so the theater route, maybe I should explain a bit. Here in India, we have ABC, three gradations of theaters, okay?
Okay.
So any big movie first releases in an A-class theater. Only when it has run out of steam in an A-class theater is it moved to a B-class theater.
Mm-hmm.
So A-class theaters will usually be in urban centers. B-class theaters will be in the smaller places.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And only when it moves from, I mean, only when enough people have watched it in B-class theaters and people do not come to theaters anymore, is it moved to the C-class theaters, which are in villages, which are like the small kind of rundown kind of theaters.
Okay.
So if in those days, if a good movie is getting released and you are not very outgoing kind of a villager, mm-hmm. you have to wait for 1.5 years before that movie will hit your village.
Of course, yes.
Yeah. This is how it used to be. Now, these things changed in the late 90s because of this film crisis in film industry. What happens is that suddenly a lot of B-class theaters gets upgraded to A-class theaters because this was the new trick which came at the end of 90s, which is that you release a movie in hundreds of theaters on the same day. Mm-hmm. So that whatever, even if the movie is not good, enough people have watched it on the first day so that you can recover your costs.
The box office numbers are inflated.
Yeah. I mean, it's not artificially.
But they look good.
Inflated.
The opening weekend looks good.
Yeah. And after that, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Because of cable television.
Yeah.
Because now now they don't have to really play through the villages. Now they can just sell it to the TV companies, right?
Right.
So there's a new economy in place. So obviously, a lot more theaters have become A-class theaters. And obviously, many more people are now watching movies on television. So this is the condition in which this guy, Salam Kodiyathur, he comes up with this idea, simple idea, now when we think of it, which is that he is not going to have a theater release at all. And these are not movies which have like great directorial skills or great acting skills. Its primary strength is that, you know, it has a local feel to it, okay? So this works well, not when it goes to a theater, but works through these cassette rental shops. So basically, he sells it directly to cassette rental shops. So it had basically in the beginning, it had a very minimal kind of a regional presence. Like, mm-hmm. you know, it will be like some 5 or 6 bus stops kind of cinema.
Okay.
5 or 6 bus stops is an, like, you know, is an understatement, but let's say 15, 20 bus stops. I mean, that kind of.
Okay, understood.
That kind of reach, yeah. Now, when CD comes, and this is what changed, is that, I mean, in my interview with him, with Salam Kodiyathur, he mentions this, which is that, see, if you have to record a cassette which runs for an hour, you have to have 1 hour. With CD, on the other hand, you can record multiple CDs at the same time, and it does not have to correspond to the running hour of the movie. Because, you know, I mean, 1 hour CD does not take 1 hour to burn, right?
Right.
And you can have these decks of CDs getting burnt at the same time.
Yes.
Now, this made it much easier. I mean, this entire networked system in which this movie is releasing, that was made so easy by this CD technology, this compact disc technology.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what also happened is that the first two movies, so there are two things. First two movies were in cassettes, and therefore it did not have much reach. But more importantly, this third movie, which was in a CD, was also shot in Qatar, in the Gulf.
Mm-hmm.
At that point of time, maybe 6 movies in this entire Malayalam film industry,
mm-hmm.
Which produces, like, let's say it has in 10 years' time, some 1,000 movies.
Okay.
Let's just imagine this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In all of that history, starting from the beginning of Gulf migration, in the late 60s to the year 2000-2001, there were a total of 6 movies perhaps which had Gulf in them.
Oh,
this real space of Gulf. Okay, not reference to Gulf,
so actually shot there.
Yeah, which was actually shot there.
Mm-hmm.
6 movies perhaps. But this guy, I mean, this kind of amateur filmmaker, I mean, he's not part of the industry. He's just a school teacher who is trying to make movies with like minimal, like unbelievably minimal budget. He shoots a movie in Qatar with actors who are mostly migrant laborers. Now that was a game changer, because before it was noticed here in Kerala, it was noticed among the migrants. And they played a big role in popularizing this, you know, this new trend called the home cinema. So basically, this is what home cinema is.
Okay.
Obviously, technology has further changed. Now there are no CD shops anymore. And it's completely on YouTube now. So still makes movies.
Okay.
And they are uploaded on YouTube. It's, I mean, the last time we spoke, he said it's not a feasible plan. But yeah, as of now, he still continues to make movies.
So why did the migrants feel so strongly about these movies? Was it only because they saw the spaces where they lived in or the people who were like them? What was the reason they associated so strongly with these movies in particular?
No, some of them were there, right, in the movie.
Right.
That is
mm-hmm.
one thing. The other reason is that, see, if you look at movies so far, I mean, which actually had Gulf in them, the Gulf in them had nothing much to do with, you know, the Gulf in which these people worked. Like, you know, it will be just these shots of buildings, and then, you know, there will be these guys with those kanduras walking around, and then some dancers and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, one thing is that these movies, so see, the thing is, when people think of Gulf, they used to think of Sharia, for example. I mean, what is our concept of Gulf? What used to be our concept of Gulf? We think of these Arabs who wear their dress.
Yeah, the thobes.
And then we think of these Sharia laws.
Right.
But as far as labor is concerned, there was nothing specific to the Gulf. earlier. People, laboring people, they have difficult lives. That is the simple understanding, right? Now, these movies, there are so many things about them, which actually, thanks for asking this question, because it also makes me think, like, you know, this specific question I had not really thought of in the paper also, which is that why this? Now, if you look at these movies, first of all, you see that much of it is moralistic. One can say that, you know, it is also giving us some advice about how to spend money, you know, how to be a good wife, that kind of thing. But that is, so that way it is formulaic. But at the same time, you will see many nuances in these movies. Even though it's, of course, it's not a great movie to watch, perhaps, but it is entertaining, not because, you know, it's some great direction or great acting, but because it actually plumbs a lot of these local milieu into it. For example, local jokes, local sayings, local idioms. Local in the sense that, you know, of course, by European standards, Kerala is a big space, right? Mm-hmm. So local in the sense that, you know, let's say a northern Kerala, for example, it has different parts of Kerala has its own localized idioms, right?
Right.
Its own
right,
localized
right.
ways of speaking, of joking, etc. Mm-hmm. Right.
Different dialects movies, and different.
Yeah, different dialects. But right. the dialect part is interesting because, you know, there's quite some difficult effort in many of these movies to somehow imitate the standard dialect. And it often fails. But, you know, but if you look at the kind of jokes that there are, not the very emotional dialogues, that is where it goes wrong. Because, you know, you try to say emotional dialogues and somehow it has to be in standard Malayalam. And the tongue just doesn't twist, you know, to pronounce the standard Malayalam. It all goes, goes all haywire. But if you look at jokes, if you look at the kind of these extras which happen in a movie, for example, like, you know, if there is a song, what right. kind of dance accompany these songs? Yeah. Or, you know, who are the people who will dance? Now, these are all very localized kind of thing. Now, the other factor which made it quite popular according to mainstream media is that in these movies, women are always, veiled is the wrong word to use, okay?
Mm-hmm.
They would have
a head covering.
They would have a head covering, not always though.
Okay.
Mostly they would have a head covering, but they would be dressed, let's say, if that is the correct word, modestly.
Okay.
Understood. So that made it, you know, quite appealing in the sense that there was some kind of a backing for this movie in this mainstream. Like, you know, the thing is, I'm not really convinced about this point though.
Really?
In the sense that this, it is not as if, with the coming of cable television, there are enough things to watch on the television. Now, you know, to watch a movie simply because it has women with head covering looks like it would give us the impression that, you know, people did not really have anything to watch. But, you know, it's also a place where mainstream film has good saturation, good permeability.
So there's a lot of options there for people.
But at the same time, there would be, of course, a section of population who never watched movies and perhaps they were attracted to these movies. But the fact is that, you know, the other things, in the sense that the fact that it has a local idiom, the fact that it has local performers, the fact that it allows you to see your own places, your own regions within the cinematic frame. I think all of that played a role, and not just, I'm not saying it did not play a role, but not just this head covering part of it.
I understand.
Now, the thing is, head covering part of it might have made it easier for people to recommend.
Right.
That is another, yeah.
Right. So families can watch it together, right? They don't have to, there are certain movies, not to point fingers at Bollywood, but there are certain movies that you cannot, you used to be able to watch a lot of the Bollywood movies together as a family. For example, you could watch maybe Mr. India and stuff. But I also remember the copy of Mr. India that we had was on VHS and it was from UAE. So any suggestive songs, there was one suggestive song, it was cut out. It was not in the movie. It was not until I was much older that I figured out that there were some songs and some scenes that were cut out. Okay. So I can see the appeal of having a movie that you can all sit together as a family and just watch and enjoy and not have to worry about anything suggestive coming on screen.
And also the fact that, you know, I mean, ultimately these movies are packaged as some pieces of advice. I mean, that also, I think, it makes it easy for people to, okay, recommend. But ultimately, I would say that the pleasure is the pleasure of watching a movie itself, right?
Definitely. Representation is important. That's why these days in Hollywood, it's such a big conversation about seeing people who are of your race, ethnicity, your same sexual orientation, for example, on screen, just so you can see yourself represented in what you're watching.
Yes. This is basically what home cinema was about. Now, at the same time, see, this is also a moment of crisis because the late 90s, early 2000s was when, because of the crisis in film industry, there was like cottage industry of soft porn. So it is also in this context that this particular movie gets a particular legitimacy because now both of these are associated with Gulf money. The history of soft porn industry is that much of it is produced by new producers who are mostly getting their money from the Gulf. This is the discourse. As against that, here is another, you know, narrative of the Gulf, which does not involve. So the other one does not have any narrative of the Gulf, but the money is, I mean, the sponsorship comes from the Gulf. But here, on the other hand, you have Gulf, but you also have these modestly dressed women. And very minimal, I mean, hardly any, I mean, there is no intimacy that way. But even, you know, very few scenes in which, you know, people have to be like opposite genders have to be in close, you know, proximity to each other.
Interesting. So how did these movies then in turn change? Would I call it Malayali or Malayalam cinema?
Malayalam. Yeah.
Malayalams, okay. So how did it change the cinema in any way? Did the locally produced movies start taking some storylines or some ideas from here?
Okay, what has changed? Now, I do not know if one can attribute it to these films. Mm-hmm. But I mean, these are like, there's no single cause, right? Of course, it's part of the cause, perhaps. Is that today you see many more movies which speak about the migrant labor for his emotional issues and not just like, you know, some labor related issues. Now that was brought forth by this home cinema movement. But one should also know that this towards the end of the 2000s, like the last decade, you already have a shift throughout, like, you know, in Bollywood also, in Tamil cinema also, and in Malayalam cinema also, in which you have diversification in terms of, as you just mentioned, in terms of representation. Earlier, you know, most of the films would be located in two or three places. But right now you have movies, I mean, whether it's Bollywood or Tamil cinema or Malayalam cinema, I'm just referring to three industries that I'm a bit familiar with. You can see the same trend everywhere, which is that they are finding new locations. They are finding new dialects. They want to localize cinema, even if it's mainstream cinema. So you will see, like, you know, one cinema dedicated to each district in Kerala, for example.
It's
like that because, you know, that is the kind of diversification which has happened. Now, one could say that it is, of course, part of an international trend itself in which, you know, you go into, I mean, under the influence of Latin American cinema, you go into, you know, all these margins, whether it's slum spaces in cities or, you know, all these villages, left out kind of villages. And then, you know, you try to portray it realistically, but at the same time, not in the slow manner of, let's say, some Italian neorealism. Like, okay. You know, those long shots in which the time would correspond. But, you know, you have fast editing, you have sharp cuts, all of that. But, you know, you try to be realistic about the dialect, about the kind of clothes which people wear, all of that. So that is an international trend, and that trend is there in India too.
Mm.
Now, the thing is, as a forerunner to all these cinemas, as a cinema which actually showed these local places and very local people, and, you know, I mean, it's poorness, like poverty, poorness, poor image, that kind of idea. I mean, it is very much there in these movies. It's quite obvious for you to see that, you know, these are not seasoned actors. I mean, that is precisely what makes you identify with this. You know, it's not even perhaps identification in that very cinematic sense, in the sense that, you know, oh, something happens to him and then I also feel that.
Mm.
Not that kind of identification, but, you know, this is, okay, this is a cinema which is, you know, something that we can make. Because, I mean, this is also the time. Okay, this is also the time in which a lot of people are making films. Now, these films are not films, but video albums, songs.
Mm.
Late 90s, early 2000s, it's like video album songs are like a cottage industry because of cable television. So this cable televisions, other apart from all these mainstream televisions, you have local televisions, right? Local channels, right? Like, you know, which is set in your village. Now, these local channels, what do they have? They will play some movies. Then they will have some local news. And the rest of the time, they have to play songs because they have nothing, which also means a lot of slots available. So it's like a place where there's a lot of scope for the talents from the locality to showcase themselves. So a lot more people are making videos. Especially the coming of the CD, a lot more people are making video songs. You can see many of them on YouTube. All of which came out in the early 2000s. It's in this particular context. I mean, this is all of these are happening at the same time. So, you know, it's that kind of identification. Like, this is also something that we can try. You understand? It's an empowering kind of identification.
Mm.
An identification which makes you think that, okay, you can also do this. Not the other kind of identification in which, you know, people on screen do what you cannot do. Like, you know, this... catharsis kind of, it's not that effect, right? It's not that kind of identification. Perhaps that also worked in favor of these kind of films.
So I now want to talk a little bit, if that would be okay, to talk a little bit about how the community itself, the migrant community, has changed. I'm assuming, and I don't know if this is true, but I think that the rate of migration has sharply dropped from how it used to be. I don't think as many people are migrating as they used to, and some of the older migrants must have come back by now to come back to their homes and families, or are they staying there? Have you seen a shift in the community and their culture since, let's say, the 90s to now, in the past decade or two?
Most of the early migrants, as I mentioned before, were of poor educational qualification, poor family, and engaged in non-productive labor. This is what scholars have said. What happens in the early 2000s is that there's a new rule that is law that is passed. I mean, new rule that is passed here, which is that unless you pass 10th standard, you cannot migrate to the Gulf. So that already brings in a shift, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because now, I remember from that time, and a lot of people who used to do daily labor during daytime, we used to have classes for them in the evenings. So a lot more people used to write. I mean, these are people who had, as in their school going age, they had dropped out.
Mm-hmm.
And now when they were... let's say in their 20s or so, they were all trying to pass the 10th standard examination by registering for the 10th standard exam, because that was a prerequisite in order to get a visa to the Gulf. What has happened is that a lot of the early migrants also got their next generation, but in better jobs than they, and with better education that they had. Hmm. That also suggests a shift. That is not to say that a lot of people still migrate to the Gulf, but the maybe one shift which has happened, I do not know how extensive the shift is, but is that earlier people just used to go thinking that, okay, something will turn up. And there was this kind of a hope about the Gulf that, you know, something will happen and then, you know, we will all be safe.
Mm.
But if you look at the late 90s, early 2000s period, what has happened is the mushrooming, actually this is more of a 2000s phenomena,
uh-huh.
mushrooming of a very targeted kind of migration. So there are all these lift technology, fire technology kind of technologies, you know, all those institutions which teach these aluminium fabrication kind of jobs.
Right.
Which are then therefore targeted, it is targeted towards migration.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's not that early kind of migration in which you just go there and find out what is there.
Okay.
It is like, you know the situation, you know that, okay, I will learn this skill so that I can get this job.
Right.
No, so that that is also a shift. In the first drop in migration happened with the first Gulf War. But then, you know, migration had again started going up in terms of numbers towards the late 90s. Now with, of course, the pandemic, there is some kind of a sharp decline, or that is what a lot of people, a lot more people coming back and a lot more people stuck here in India. I mean, they had come here and now they cannot go back.
Right.
That situation has happened. And of course, there's scholarly literature coming out on these aspects.
That is very interesting. But I'm glad to hear that maybe with this generalization and specification of the trades and skills that the migrants are using, that situations will improve and that the general working and living conditions will have improved as well since the very beginning of when the migrants were going there illegally, for example. So, Professor, as we try to wrap this up, I do want to ask you, having lived through this migrant experience and having studied it professionally, having like an emotional connection to it, having this academic connection to it, what is the main takeaway, if I can even ask something so, you know, cliched as that, but what is like a main takeaway that you would maybe want to share with us and our listeners about these migration patterns and the migrants and their culture, or just something interesting maybe that you'd like to share?
I mean, my take on this would be that perhaps we need to imagine a place as belonging to us, not only because we labor there, but we have also spent our hours of leisure there. Perhaps it is, it requires us to shift our imagination such that, you know, we need to think of leisure as creating a space, a different temporality, a different space, and which can in itself be a claim to belong. And once we do this, then perhaps we can see the migrants not just as laborers, but people who contribute, perhaps not in these high cultural terms, but contribute to the daily cultural life, the smiles, our smiles, our emotions, our affects.
Mm-hmm.
And this perhaps is the claim to belong. That would be my argument.
That's a very lovely and profound thought. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. And thank you to everyone for listening. This is the Culturico podcast. You can check out our articles and other podcasts on our website. And we hope to have more interesting content coming for you and being available on our website. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for listening to me.